Northwestern University, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Ripper.
Northwestern University is celebrating its centennial year. 100 years of service to the nation and the great Northwest.
Today, the reviewing stand asks the question, is World War III inevitable? Our unrehearsed give-and-take discussion will center around an analysis of the factors which may lead to war and methods of dealing with these factors. Now, our moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, will introduce participants in today's discussion. Mr. McBurney.
Our speakers today are Stringfellow Barr, former president of St. John's College, and author of the recent pamphlet, Let's Join the Human Race, and William McGovern, professor of political science at Northwestern University. Now let's look at our question, gentlemen. Is World War III inevitable? What do you say to that, Mr. Barr?
Well, I would suppose, Mr. McBurney, that if we continued our foreign policy, if we continued to behave in the way we have been behaving and doing the things we've been doing, that we'll end in a world war rather soon, because we're engaged in the greatest arms race in history, and I think it's pretty obvious where arms races end. On the other hand, it's not inevitable that we continue as we've gone. And the future is never bound in that way. We could change our policies and postpone rather indefinitely.
Well, where do you stand on the question, McGovern?
Well, I agree with Mr. Barr that nothing is inevitable in life except death and taxes. On the other hand, I don't believe that this war is inevitable, but for different reasons than Mr. Barr. I think we are drifting into this war. I think we're drifting into this war by the policy of appeasement, which still dominates so much of our State Department thinking. World war is inevitable if we are weak, and Russia is strong. World war can and easily be prevented if we are strong, stronger than our enemies.
Well, now, what are some of the factors leading us toward war? McGovern suggests that Russia is the principal factor standing between mankind and world peace. Do you accept that thesis, Mr. Barr?
No, and I don't think the bulk of the human race accepts it. I think that for the bulk of mankind, a very acute mass misery in the world is the basic problem that stands between us and a happy, peaceful world. And it's a mass misery that Russia is exploiting by offering what she claims is a solution to the misery. And to date, I don't think we've made any effective offer of a solution.
Well, I will disagree with that for many reasons. Basically, we've got to face the fact that the communist powers, whatever it may be, Russia, the satellite powers, and China, are part of a worldwide conspiracy, an ideological conspiracy armed by brute force to seize control of the rest of the world. I don't think that the millennium will come if and when Russia is defeated or Red China is defeated. The threat to war is an immediate known source, and they are utilizing, sometimes in Europe, sometimes in Asia, armed forces to overrun the free world. That is the aggressor, and the aggressor must be stopped if we're trying to prevent a worldwide catastrophe.
I don't think most of the human race, Mr. McGovern, is trying to get the millennium. I think they're trying to get a few square meals, which is quite a different objective.
Well, certainly, as far as that's concerned, that, judging by all the facts and figures that we know, what's going behind the, going behind the Iron Curtain, whether it's in Russia or whether it's in China, there is more misery there than even in the bad places such as India and elsewhere, which are outside of the Iron Curtain.
But the Indian doesn't know much about what's going on behind the Iron Curtain, does he? He only knows he's hungry, and he only knows that the Russians claim a solution for that.
Yes, of course. On the other hand, the Russians have been able to secure control of any area to date without the use of armed forces. In other words, whether it's in Czechoslovakia, Hungary, or Poland, or whether it's in Korea or in Red China, it has been the armed forces, the communists, well-trained and organized and put their wicked dictatorship upon the people.
And they've always had people in the countries that went in to cooperate with them on the basis, of their offer.
Where you have a staunch monarchist, as far as that's concerned, the Chinese communists have made no attempt to convert the people to communism. They're less than 1% are allowed to be members of the Communist Party. They'll try to weaken their by the making of divide up their opinions, but the control is vested in a very small group of people.
Well, it is in Russia, obviously.
That's a bit of a trap. In other words, it is the same the world over. It is a conspiracy of a small group of professional ideologues backed up by a great number of divisions to impose their might upon countries. They find weak and open to them.
Well, isn't there a question, though, whether communist arms would be as successful as they've been if the program of the communists was not appealing to people in the countries that they enter?
Yes, no, of course, undoubtedly. Let's take it this way. If war were to break out in Western Europe tomorrow, you'd find 15 to 20% of the French people who would be actively pro-Russian, an equal number in Italy. On the other hand, we've got to face the equal fact that the majority of the people in Italy, France, and England are definitely anti-communist. And we've also got to remember that behind the Iron Curtain, there wouldn't be 20 to 25% of the people who sympathize with us. It would be closer to 60 to 80% who would be sympathetic to us.
Well, now, Barr is suggesting here, McGovern, that we have millions of people in misery, and that Russia is offering to them what appears to be an answer.
Only needs to appear. It only needs to appear. We don't need to waste time discussing whether it is.
We're agreed on that. It appears to be such an answer. On the other side, we offer no such program. Nothing that appears to them, apparently, to be an answer to the misery. In other words, you've got a social revolution on your hands here, and we're responding to it by force of arms.
Well, as a matter of fact, the social revolution has never brought about this the conquest of a single area. That's what I'm saying. You have economic unrest in India. But as far as that's concerned, that doesn't bring on communism without the communist arms. The number of people who are pro-communist in India is very small. Nehru, for other reasons and not for economic reasons, is mildly anti-American and mildly pro-Russian. There's an economic factor involved there. It's a national factor.
Are you suggesting, Mr. McGovern, that Mao succeeded only by arms? Or did he succeed because he used not only arms, but that he offered a program of land reform to the peasants?
As far as
there's a famous communist slogan, shoot your landlord and pay off your mortgage.
That is the product is a very new and very interesting thing, how the communists the propaganda by departing radically from Karl Marx. They claim to be the
same. Well, they'll never hesitate. But isn't that, in terms of Mr. McBurney's question, isn't it offering a program to people that they want?
Yes, but what are we offering to them? We're offering them to aid them in independence. Let them solve their own problems in a way to suit them. We're not trying to impose
but
American
does that mean anything for a hungry man? If you say, we'll let you solve your own problem, and he says, I have a landlord and a usurer on my back.
Yes, as far as that's concerned, we see that the land reforms in China work out disastrously. As far as that's concerned, those people in China, there's enormous unrest in China, because they find the land reforms in China work out much more misery than good.
That might well be, and we agreed, I think, just now, that we would not waste time arguing over whether the communist solution is a good solution. But before the reforms are put through, I would judge that the offers that Mao boys made very heavily.
I appeal, but that didn't make it to the people. The National Army is not the Mao propaganda they made. In other words, the weakness and inefficiency of the National Army is rather than the economic factors, it was the really determining factor there. In other words, but I think, Mr. Barr, that you make a serious mistake, a mistake made by some in the classical economists, in which you think that economic factors are the only, or in any case, the main factor in determining action. I believe, as a matter of fact, men are fundamentally irrational, and the non-rational, non-economic factors are just as important. I mean, take, for example, Western India. The enormous fight between Pakistan and Hindustan, the fight over Kashmir, has nothing whatever to do with an economic basis. All that is a question of a religious factor.
I mean, I defend myself against the accusation of being a classical economist, or like them. When a man is sufficiently hungry, it doesn't seem to me to make too much sense to say that men are not motivated by economics. He doesn't think about economics. He thinks about bread. And he'll do a great many things that may look very irrational to a man that's been well fed, but he does them because he's hungry.
Of course, McGovern looks at that analysis of yours and looks at the record and takes the position that the factor that has counted has been the military force of Russia.
Well, I think many people would disagree with him. I mean, a great many people watch
Just look at the facts. Tell me of one country that has gone communist without the force of use of armed forces.
Tell me of one in which the other factor didn't enter, didn't soften them up. Even Czechoslovakia.
Of course, other factors come into it. As far as that's concerned, other factors, the thing that we're trying to preach them here is independence. We've aided the various Asiatic
powers. Does this hungry man think independence makes a problem?
In many cases, he is more concerned over that than he is over economic factors.
Don't you think in many cases he's more concerned with some food than with the status of his government?
In many cases, no, that's strange enough. You would think it's irrational, but it is.
We haven't joined the issue. I said, don't you think in many cases he's more concerned with food?
In many cases where they do not concern economic factors.
And supposing I admit that, you are admitting my contention that in many cases that is his prime concern. How hungry are these people, anyway? Well, I think in a great many parts of the world, they're rather desperate, they're hungry. In the parts that are not desperate, hunger is a fairly grave concept. Sometimes it's just a matter of malnutrition. That is, people are able to get something to put in their bellies, but it's not the right thing to put in their bellies. And they're weak, they're not productive, they're not able to work, they are more readily subject to disease, and the bulk of them are sick. And I think you've got a first-class mess on your hands.
But isn't this a first-class mess that these people have lived with for years?
Yes, I think the new factor is not the mess, although sometimes it's worse than it was. The new factor, however, is that these people are now convinced, or their leaders are convinced, speaking of the peasant, has no view except that life is agony. But their leaders are convinced that the mess is no longer necessary because of the technology that... the Occident developed.
Well, of course, I'm going to break in here, Mr. Barr, if I may, at the moment, and say that some of the real troubles in the world, certainly in Japan, in China, and in India, are overpopulation. That is not true in other areas. But those areas you have got, simply the land will not and cannot support that huge population. And that population has been increasing year by year, especially since 1800. In other words, the British came into India there in 1757. India had a population of 150. It was all, even then, there was much starvation, much misery, much famine. But even so, India could physically support 150 or even 200 million. But when she is now trying to support 400 million people, simply cannot be done on the land available.
And yet, it's an interesting fact, isn't it, that the Indian Socialist Party has as one of its major, one of the major planks in its platform, the development of the cultivable waste in India, land that's not being put to any use.
And as far as that's concerned, we have had experts working for years in our agricultural missions there in China to see what can be done to aid Chinese agriculture. Just as the British for years and years had these various irrigation projects in India, and they've invested millions of acres there through the irrigation. But the trouble is that the more land you open up to scientific agriculture, the more they produce children, overpopulation becomes even greater at the end of 2 years.
Well, very apparently, gentlemen, there are two facets to this problem, the economic facet and the military and the political.
I would like to add the psychological factor, which is a very important factor. In other words, your whole nationalism is a psychological factor.
I take
factor.
It borrowed or the hatred of the white man in areas where he's dominated.
Well, in terms of the military and political, are you satisfied with the policy we're now pursuing in the government?
Very far from it. I think that we've had one of the stupidest foreign policies, especially in connection with the Far East. We've had no policy. We've contradicted ourselves every few weeks, in many cases every few days. Yet, as far as that's concerned, from 1945, I think that our policy in the Far East has been perfectly disastrous. We are largely responsible for the mess over there because it was through our appeasement policy that Mao got control over China. We then, in 1950, January 6, 1950, announced to the world, we're not concerned about Korea. If anyone grabs Korea, we're not concerned about it. We're just simply giving a green light to the communists to grab. Then when they do grab, overnight, we announce that we do and are concerned and are going to fight. Since then, we've tried various other policies about Formosa. Yes, we're going to keep Formosa. No, we don't care about Formosa. We will give Formosa to the communists. Oh, no, we're going to see the communists. We have no policy. And we're now fighting a war in Korea, a bitter, brutal war with 1,000 casualties a week, in which I have our commander's hands are tied behind me.
May I, since I disagree With most of the views Mr. McGovern has expressed, I heartily agree with the one he just expressed. I don't think what we've been doing can be dignified by the word foreign policy. On the other hand, I think we have got a foreign policy now that is not, to use a word he used, drift, and that's rearmament. I think that's going to be better. Can you object to that? I don't think that's the answer to the problem I'm concerned about. Is it part of the answer to the problem? Not quite. Because these people can't eat the arms we're making. There are two problems, I take it. One is that the problem I try to indicate that we're not going to have peace in the world as long as these people are in this condition. And know that they don't have to be. Because the world of population thing is a very complicated problem in a great many areas where misery is acute, and if anything, the country's underpopulated. I think of many parts of Latin America I'm familiar with. But I think there's another problem, and that is we're locked in a power struggle with Russia.